Alright, everyone. We're on paper 113, section 2, which is old single column, page 1242. Alright, so as you remember, we just got rolling on this paper, and maybe just two couple of points to reset in your mind as we go forward. Remember how they started it out with section entitled The Guardian Angels. And now we're moving to the Destiny Guardians. So they must be wanting to do some contrast there. You'll see that right away when we start reading. And then the other thing that I pointed out that will definitely pull out as we go through the paper quite a bit. As you'll see, it's very obvious how they're stressing this, that you have two papers on the seraphim for a very definite reason. The first is relating to the mother-like ministry of the seraphim. The second is to the father-like ministry. And the fact that this is very definitively the mother-like ministry of the seraphim, you want to keep that in mind to think about how that's really critical to understand the nature of the ministry, the nature of their relationship to you, the nature of just how they conduct themselves, etc. So keep that in mind, and how we've really develop now a pretty good sense of that differential, that all can kind of be summed up in a complementary pair of conceptual starting points of the father-like side is rooted in I am, and the mother-like side is rooted in all are. And that fundamental difference between those two aspects of deity expression. And of course, a big parallel to that that twofold expression is existential, experiential. Not all of what goes under the banner of God the Mother is pure experiential, but it definitely is tied to experiential in order to have that characteristic of God the Mother likeness, whereas God the Father likeness is definitely very rooted in in the existential side of the equation. Okay, so who would like to read for us here? Go ahead.
Sure. The Destiny Guardians, number 2. Seraphim are not known as guardians of destiny until such time as they are assigned to the association of a human soul who has realized one or more of three achievements, has made a supreme decision to become godlike, has entered the third circle, or has been mustered into one of the reserve corps of destiny.
Okay, see, so that first little thing, and it's the final paragraph, but you need to really make sure you've absorbed that. So if even if you've been reading for a long time, if that's never really sunk in, let it sink in really now. Because you want to watch that as you're reading through this paper. Are they talking about just guardian angels? Which you could either think of as the term prior, to roughly third circular, relationship to you, or a general term. They're all guardian angels, but specifically, when they go into that two-on-one mode, then they're guardians of destiny. And remember how in the previous section, I mentioned last time that there was a lot of things that were sort of foreshadowing in the previous section that they didn't pick up on here in this one. Remember how they said, they talked about the, and they italicized, the supreme decision? And they don't explain, exactly what makes it the and not just a. And you see, here it is. You know, specifically, when we're talking about a supreme decision to become godlike, that's the supreme decision. And there's a lot, many other, possible supreme decisions. But you know, when they say the one, that's what they're talking about. That real decision that is so fraught with truth. That it's equivalent in many instances to third circular. You initiate a number of the third circle like relationships to the cosmos in advance because of the supremacy and the specificity of that decision.
It seems like that's I think we've probably all done that. But there must be a difference between...
You made a decision to become godlike, but you see that, and again, you have to remind yourself.
That's what I'm saying.
The word supreme means something very different than humans have ever, used it for. And we've tried to kind of stress that. That's that really coming to challenge yourself to have this fully fleshed out understanding that goes under the banner of God the Mother. It's not just an incidental notion. To say it's a supreme decision means that it's hard to even imagine how you do this. Somehow, you have actually expanded the character of that decision so that it conforms to the completed finite domain. What does that even mean exactly? See, I mean, there's no way you can somehow write that down and then try to come up with a technique that, you can't even comprehend, none of us can even remotely comprehend literally what that is. But you know that you can do it because you have within your mind, an adjuster, nothing else. Now, of course, they point out that this can even happen... as a way of getting an adjuster to come, it's in a pre-Pentecost state, which is even harder to comprehend. But at least for you and I, it's like, maybe I can imagine that somehow I there's such a full consecration of my mind to cosmic harmony. And this is the difference. It's not the intensity of the consecration of your will to the will of the Father. It's the completeness of the consecration of your mind to the harmony, the universal harmony of God the Mother, that makes this supremacy of decision. So it's extensive in that sense.
Is that what they were referring to when they talked about Paul on the road to Damascus and Gautama under the
there's possible examples like that you might reflect on as being those sorts of situations.
But it obviously starts with sincerity.
It's going to have to be very sincere. Yeah. And I was just kind of trying to, when I said it's that kind of extensive, and that's really kind of the key. We've pointed out this before, of reflecting on the difference between extensive and intensive. the consecration of your will to the will of God the Father is an intent. See, it's a very intensive thing, which could have various degrees of intensiveness. Here we're talking about degrees of extensiveness. That I let my horizons expand within me, so that at least in full potential, I've engaged the cosmos, and now I'm going to begin to actually try to, to actualize and realize that. But I potentialized it. I've potentialized it to the limits of supremacy. Even though I'm a long ways. I'm not even literally a third circler yet, let alone a seventh. A seventh order spirit.
You've talked before about the basically the grace factor of short-circuiting, the being able to go to
it. Right. So you can wonder if the spirit of truth helps out with this, see?
And the thought adjuster.
You know, and why would you specifically wonder that? Not just because, well, maybe he has another thing, maybe he does something magical, but think, you know, there's a literal thing there. What, when Michael became, a master's son, he embraced supremacy. That's what he was doing. He was getting closer and closer to being able to actually having a full, grip on supremacy, and he achieved that as a master's son. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's his spirit of truth ministry. See, so that would certainly help in this regard, of being able to somehow reach out and grab supremacy like that. Now, if your mind comes up short,
put on the mind of Christ.
Right.
There you go.
Specifically the spirit of truth. See, so just, that... So you can just really start to think about how there's a number of ways that you can appreciate this literally from a lot of things that you already know, from even the Jesus papers. Okay.
Hey, Chris.
Yeah.
How many is a company compared to a group?
We'll get there. It's a company is 144 pairs.
A group is?
That's just 12 pairs.
Thank you.
That's actually coming up here in just a little bit. So I was going to hearken us back to that. All right. So now they just picked up and kind of giving you the full picture on that little sort of footnote that they had back there when they were talking about the super minded ones, the super normal minded, that you have these three different benchmarks. Being mustered in the reserve corps, making the supreme decision, or becoming a third circler. Right, and at that point, you get your own pair of now guardians of destiny, not just guardian angels. Lots of new possibilities are in play. All right, so the next one.
In the evolution of races, a guardian of destiny is assigned to the very first being who attains the requisite circle of conquest. On Urantia, the first mortal to secure a personal guardian was Rantawak, a wise man of the red race of long ago.
Okay. Now, I can't help but notice here. Okay. So, it says that he... was a man of great wisdom. But it seems like he probably was also, even as a young boy, based upon his name, he was probably a young boy of quite a bit of wisdom. I can just picture this. Ran, stubbed toe, now walk. It just looked like the wisdom of a little child to me. I don't know. Who knows what the literal meaning of that red man tongue name is there.
Saw that coming.
How do you get a name like him?
Anyway, but notice how unsurprising this statement is, or it should be, now that we've sort of really emphasized this for years now, the difference between the races. The red man fundamentally favors the sixth adjutant. That's why. He's always on the leading edge of these phenomena. He's on the leading edge on a normal world of the colored races that first cross that boundary of will dignity, become true humans. It's because of that the red race favors that spirit of zeal, that energy of zeal, They just have a little bit more impulse internally pushing them forward.
Look at the word they use, conquest.
Yeah.
That's a strong word, conquest.
Right. And it, so it's not surprising that it would have been a red man that crossed that boundary for the first time, becoming a third circler. It's exactly the same phenomenon as them being the first ones to become will creatures on a normal world. And and John's point is, you know, is well taken. You know, this, we've tried to stress this a number of times, that there's nothing magical about this. There's not even something that is just, I have this completely intent, you know, consecration of my will, and therefore it is. That's not the way this works. You have to burn lots of calories. It is a long, hard journey of great conquest to get yourself from a seventh circler to a third circler. You know, this bringing yourself into greater and greater relationship with God the Mother is very different than God the Father. And that difference is one of the most important things, like I've tried to stress, that the revelators are trying to bring out in the fifth epical revelation. Because we need to recognize that the answers to our problems lie a long, long ways away from mere wishful thinking, even supreme wishful thinking. You know, you just can't, you know, clench your fists and, you know, and wish really hard and the world's problems are going to be solved. It's, you know, that's not how, you know, how God the Mother becomes more manifest in the world. It's through a lot of intense calorie-burning labor, you know, that we claw our way up and struggle. And that's why anyone who remembers how this paper goes, we go forward and we see about what especially the Guardians of Destiny, do relative to you. It's why they do what they do. You know, they aren't there just trying to, you know, now think really hard, close your eyes and click your heels. You know, that isn't the voice of your angel. We all know what the real relationship is. Okay? That, you know, just noticing how that they put that right up front, see, to really catch your attention. You know, how many times have we noticed this, the way they start out a section? You know, they want you to really, really spend some time, even if it's just three sentences. You know, there's a reason why they're up front. They want you to really, really get those firmly in your head, what they're saying right at the beginning, because that is the point of everything that follows. You know, if you want to understand what follows, those initial points have to be firmly in your grip. You can't just let them flow through and go on to the next paragraph. You've got to take them forward, you know, to understand.
All angelic assignments are made from a group of volunteering seraphim, and these appointments are always in accordance with human needs and with regard to the status of the angelic pair. In the light of seraphic experience, skill, and wisdom. Only seraphim of long service, the more experienced and tested types, are assigned as destiny guards. Many guardians have gained much valuable experience on those worlds which are of the non-adjuster fusion series. Like the adjusters, the seraphim attend these beings for a single lifetime and then are liberated for new assignments. Many guardians on Urantia have had this previous practical experience on other worlds. When human beings fail to survive, their personal or group guardians may repeatedly serve in similar capacities on the same planet. The seraphim develop a sentimental regard for individual worlds and entertain a special affection for certain races and types of mortal creatures with whom they have been so closely and intimately associated. The angels develop an abiding affection for the human associates, and you would, if you could only visualize the seraphim, develop a warm affection for them. Divested of material bodies, given spirit forms, you would be very near the angels in many attributes of personality. They share most of your emotions and experience some additional ones. The only emotion actuating you, which is somewhat difficult for them to comprehend, is the legacy of animal fear that bulks so large in the mental life of the average inhabitant of Urantia. The angels really find it hard to understand why you will so persistently allow your higher intellectual powers, even your religious faith, to be dominated by fear, so thoroughly demoralized by the thoughtless panic of dread and anxiety.
Okay, a couple little things just to draw there, back a little ways. Notice how they're giving you some contrast. You know, we've spoken so many times, you know, visualizing that we have these two wings that branch out from our core, our heart, the temple, you know, the center of our being, you know, one engaging ourself, one engaging the cosmos, and how the adjuster is fostering this linkage to the cosmos, you know, linking the cosmos to the temple, and the angel is working on linking the self to the temple. you know, now that's why we have the word contemplative, you know, the root word is temple, literally, and that's, you know, because that's that place where you have, you know, the contemplative perspective. You know, it means you are thoroughly there and looking at things from there, not from over here at the self, looking up at the temple, but looking down to the self. And, you know, you have prayerful contemplation and you have worshipful contemplation. This whole, you know, a basic two-winged, you know, engagement from that core that you have. And you know, and how parallel it is in many ways. But they're pointing out, you know, some of the differences. Notice that, you know, notice what they said, that if, you know, an individual doesn't survive, unlike with the adjuster, that almost never, you know, would come back to another individual on that planet, you know, as their adjuster. Very, very rare. It's quite common that the angel might serve again on that planet many, 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 many times, in fact. And of course, you might kind of expect that. I mean, the very fact that one of them is initially, you know, one pair is engaging 1,000, you know, seven circlers, you know, that kind of ties in with that. But even beyond that, so they're trying to point out. I mean, it's, you know, it's just really pointing out this difference, you know, between, you know, the type of relationship that these two spirit ministries have to a given world. You know, and they really stress that by pointing out, I mean, this relationship is really, really at the feeling level, just like you and I is that simple little child self can understand really well. Your angels have a lot of that. You know, they really get attached to the red man, for instance, you know, and, you know, really, really want to kind of dedicate, you know, the next, you know, 10 million years of their life to trying to help that or whatever, you know. It's, you know, so they have that kind of real attachment of self to self. And then notice the other little thing at the end there. How you know, how strong they are. You know, even your religious faith to be so dominated by fear, so thoroughly demoralized by the thoughtless panic of dread and anxiety. You know, and again, you should immediately get a very literal picture of that. You know, and the levels of meaning. The moral level is the fifth level. Okay, so not just fuzzy demoralized, literally. You know, you are dropping yourself down so that there's almost no connection with the levels that are up in the temple domain there. You know, the heart of your domain. Okay? So, when, you know, when they say demoralized by thoughtless panic of dread and anxiety, you know, where is dread? And then maybe, we've never talked about this, where might anxiety be in that picture? Now, you know that on that first level of meaning, that level of the flesh, you know, you have anguish and dread as the two endpoints. So you go from the first to the third adjective. You know, so think about anxiety. The anxiety is also down there in the level of flesh. Anxiety is, you know, is related to that second adjective. You know, you because you have this very immature, right down there against the zeroth level, the level of fear, right down there against the level of fear, you've got this very immature connection to quasi-spiritual consciousness in the third adjutant, you know? And at that level, you know, directly in contact with dread, with fear, it becomes dread, You know, that ability to sort of have a unity-like relationship to fear, where you spread it out and fill all space with it, and it's dread, you know, just, you know, filling every crevice of, you know, of your consciousness. You know, that's you can only do that because you have this unity consciousness potential within you to stretch it out like that. You know, and then if you put that immature spiritual notion in there of dread, you know, what is your associative adjutant? You know, it's like, okay, I'm looking at that, and now I'm really anxious about that. Look, you know, and what you down at the more individual level, you know, you're in anguish. Anguish, anxiety, and dread down there, you know, that's what they become if all they are is contact with fear. You know, the level of flesh doesn't have to be just that, but if you are really demoralized, if you just let material gravity pull you all the way down to the bottom of the bilges here in your mind, you know, that's all that's down there is fear. And all of these exaltations of fear, anguish, anxiety, and dread.
Yeah. It's interesting what they don't say.
Yeah.
They don't say the angels really find it hard to understand why you so persistently allow your intellectual, higher intellectual powers, even your religious faith, mm-hmm. to be so dominated by sexual attraction mm-hmm. or attraction to the opposite sex.
Right.
And it says that they don't understand the thoughtless panic of dread and anxiety, but they don't say that other thing. So that says to me that the angels clearly have some form of attraction to the opposite sex. They work in pairs. They understand our emotions, right? Didn't we just read this?
Well, they definitely have pair bonding.
Emotions.
Remember, you don't want to call it sex, though.
Positive and negative.
Positive and negative. Aggressive, retiring.
So they understand those feelings within us, which
sure.
you might read to say they also have similar feelings.
Right. Right. And you know they also have non-sexual liaisons on high.
Exactly.
And, you know, there's all those elements in play too.
Yeah.
However, there's the flip side of your statement. Don't put it so much towards them, what that says about them. But think about what it says about you and I, that isn't what the paragraph said. You know, and that should remind you of right at the end of paper 34, when we're talking about the creative mother spirit and where these seraphim originate. The normal urges of animal beings and the natural appetites and impulses of the physical nature are not in conflict with even the highest spiritual attainment, except in the minds of ignorant, mistaught, or unfortunately over-conscientious persons. One of my favorite lines. Yeah, unfortunately over-conscientious. Right? I mean, even though, you know, hunger and sex drive are the, you know, two, you know, strongest animal impulses, you know, what does it say there? Those normal urges are not, you know, the devil. But for how long has mankind labeled those, you know, the devil made me do it, and all those sorts of things. You know, that if only you could somehow sever, you know, your foundation in the material, then you could be spiritual. No. Okay? And again, what does it say? Are not in conflict with even the highest spiritual attainment. Except, you know, if you falsely exalt that which is irrelevant into something that is, I mean, you can make nothing something, if you want, within your head. Not out here. The rest of the universe is, you know, still sees it as nothing. But within here, your nothing can become everything. And if your nothing becomes everything, then you cease to exist. Because then you have no relationship to the real something. Yeah. Yeah. So think about how potentially dangerous, you know, to be unfortunately over-conscientious, you know. You know, if it's not just you know, very, very much slowing you way, way down from the progress you could be making. You know, you might actually be setting the seeds for some real problems, you know, because it's making so much of the universe in your mind, the self. Remember, we talked about that. You want the temple to be here and the self to be over there, the parent to be here, the child to be there. If you bring the child into the temple and make the temple all about the exaltation of self, then you've got self-righteousness and, you know.
Hey, Chris.
Yep.
One more on this point.
Mm-hmm.
They use the words, the angels develop an abiding affection.
Mm-hmm.
So if they can have an abiding affection for us, and you think about this concept, I have an affection for you. It's very intimate. It's very personal, isn't it? So if they can have an abiding affection for us, what do they have for their mate? It makes sense that it would be like that because they're not that much higher than us. But it's also reassuring to know that the universe, that it doesn't go from a human to, I don't know, some kind of being up there that doesn't have those tender, sweet, emotional feelings. And it's real. We know it's real when a husband and a wife or a couple love each other, help each other, have affection for one another. And to picture the angels right above us and those that are watching over us having those same kinds of feelings, which I insinuate, well, they say it, for us, let alone for themselves, really makes the universe a very friendly place to be, doesn't it?
Yeah, and think about the one other little thing that they add to that, so that it's not just an insinuation, I mean, you know, an implication, it's literally so. I mean, yeah, they're not male and female, you know, that's not the appropriate thing, but there's a definite pair phenomenon there, and the super additive potential in that differential is very important to engage things. Like, for instance, it's not just male and female-like pairs, you know, that need to have parental experience before you leave Jerison. Yeah, remember, they point out that positive-negative pairing phenomenon is important to engage into that child-rearing phenomena, you know, or process with the material sons and daughters. And they make a point of bringing that out. See, so, you know, again, you know, just to how parallel it is. It's different, but in many ways it's very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Even to that degree of that relationship of the pair to a child. All right.
All seraphim have individual names, but in the records of assignment to world service, they are frequently designated by their planetary numbers. At the universe headquarters, they are registered by name and number. The destiny guardian of the human subject used in this contactual communication is number 3 of group 17 of company 126 of battalion 4 of unit 384 of Legion 6, of Host 37, of the 182,314th Seraphic Army of Nebadon. The current planetary assignment number of this seraphim on Urantia and to this human subject is 3,641,852.
Okay, this is what I was just... You know, mentioning a little bit ago.
You think they got his number?
When Mo was bringing up those designations. If you can't remember where it is that they lay that out, it's back in, let's see, this is paper 38, I think. Yeah, back in paper 38, section 6, which is a nice little number to go with all these numbers, page 421. So it's kind of an easy one to remember. If you like numbers, that's where they lay this all out. How they organize these angels in groups of 12 pairs. So that's the initial collection, and then it goes up through all those different orders, like they were just laying out there. Where, like I said, a company is 12 of those groups, so it's 144 pairs. Etc., going up by factors of 12, all the way up to the level of an army. You know, which if you're on that, it's in the second paragraph there, when they bring that up. See, 12 such hosts make up the largest operating organization of Seraphim, an angelic army. And see how many that is. That's 35,831,808. You know, almost 36 million pairs of angels in one army. So, you know, when they say that he's in the, you know, basically 182,000 army times 36 million pairs of everyone, there's a lot of angels. Okay?
Yeah.
Give you some idea. You know, who knows how much bigger than this number the number of armies goes.
Yeah. Somewhere in the middle.
It's a lot of angels, and they're all, and despite the fact that there's just gazillions of them like this, they're all very, very precisely ordered in this extremely hierarchical structure.
Do you remember how many, was it legions? How many, what was the word they used that they were at the Michael's command?
That's the paragraph right there. Okay. Jesus alluded to such a group of angels that night in the Garden of Gethsemane when he said, "I can even now ask my Father, and he will presently give me more than 12 legions of angels." Okay, see, 12 legions is a host.
12 times.
Okay, a host is almost 3 million pairs.
Okay.
Wow. Hey Chris, so on Tuesday night's class we talked about the difference between the term the kingdom of God and Jesus being able to use the terms like family of God or the other much more personal concepts than the kingdom of God.
Right.
So why here do you think they elected to use the word army of Nebadon, seraphic army of Nebadon, instead of seraphic family of Nebadon, seraphic any other words that might have conjured up a different idea than the word army?
The main reason is, you know, that they would use that biblical, you know, terminology like that and sort of give it a whole new, you know, credence, is coming up in the next paper. The revelation that, there's a subset of the totality of angels, you know, especially if you go beyond seraphim to all the other angels, that are involved in this very definitive mother-like ministry. And you use the, you know, the pronouns, you know, she and her, you know, to talk about them in that mode. But it's only in that mode that, you know, that it's really logical to say she is doing this, you know, or that's her job. In other settings, they're in a very father-like ministry mode, and you'll see, you know, even in this, even in the context of Guardians of Destiny, they're going to point up, you know, in a couple seconds there, that occasionally they set this mother-like ministry mode aside and do the intervention mode. You know, the father-like mode, an injection into place, and you know, I don't want to dwell on it too much because it you know, when we get to the next paper, you know, and we're reading through the Master Seraphim, you know, I want to make sure everyone really recognizes something this just that most people just pass right by in there, that is one of the most amazing statements in the entire book. You know, in terms of, you think army seems like a strong thing to say. Yeah. Wait till we talk about that statement. They're trying to, you know, it's the same way that they just tried to remind us that there's a very definitive calorie-burning conquest that you have to do. The universe is a real place, and it's gritty down at the lower level. You know, it's not that notion that we've all, you know, so long had, where it's only gritty on this benighted sphere, and then boink, you know, magic, light, and life, you know, after this. You know, why would you ever need an army in heaven? You know, it's perfect up there. No, it's not. You know, there are rebellions up there. There's a lot of difficulties up there.
And humans up there.
You've got to struggle through.
We're up there.
Yikes. If nothing else, yeah. You know, you're at least up there. Right. So, you know, the amazing thing about the revelation is that they don't avoid all of the hard issues. You know, there's countless difficult issues that they very directly present in this book. But at the same time, they give you the balance that you need for that. You know, to let the angels really, literally have armies, and for that to not dominate, you know, your whole universe, you know, your whole cosmic viewpoint, you need an even deeper appreciation of the love of God to pair up with that, so that your relationship to things doesn't go out of balance. You know, there's two sides. You know, the love of the Father is doing everything infinitely possible to rule in your heart. But that doesn't mean that the Most Highs don't rule in the kingdoms of men at the same time. And sometimes that's very tough medicine. Now, the two are equally true. Very, very strong on both sides. Just as much as there is love in the universe, there is law. If they weren't in equal balance, then either, you know, the eternal sun would tip the scales against the Isle of Paradise, or the Isle of Paradise would tip the scales against the eternal sun. But they don't. They're in perfect balance. Okay? Love and law. Okay? So that's, you know, a big part of Revelation. And being able to see those simultaneously, not in conflict, but in harmony, is the fifth epical revelation encouragement. Take up this new challenge to not close your eye to law and only open your eye to love. Or the other way, you're really hard-hearted. You know, open both eyes, see them both, engage them both fully, and begin to see, you know, it's only with the law that the love has its full glory, and vice versa. You know, without the law, the love is nothing. You know, it's just wishful thinking about nothing. You want that law to be literally engaging something. So there has to be just as much law as there is love. All right, yeah. So there it is. That wonderful little list. It just kind of reminds you of the sticking, you know, this planet in the whole cosmic hierarchy, you know, we're, you know, in this system number, this constellation number, etc. You know, it's a similar sort of list here. And, you know, most of the time the exact number is not that important. You know. But, yeah, when you hear legion or host, you're starting to talk about really big numbers.
So that harkens back to what's between love and law, which is back on page 315 with the mercy reflectors, that if you want to have mercy, you got to have first, where is it?
Justice.
First just, next fair, then patient, then kind, then mercy. So if love and law have to be in balance, then justice and mercy have to be in balance. Of course, patience is in the middle, but that also means that fairness and kindness have to be in balance. So it moves in like that, with the pivot point being patience.
Right.
Yeah, I like that.
Right. Nice. Yeah. Like I try to point out, you know, that whole, how is, you know, all that stuff I just said, that all sounded fine and dandy, but, you know, I don't, you know, what if you don't have any way to do such a thing as engage both of those and bring them together? Well, you do. You have this full relationship with the levels of meaning. The zeroth level is the level of law. Sixth level is the level of love.
Yeah.
You know, and seeing how you move in, you know, mercy, justice, you know, et cetera. You know, it moves in, and that balance point is patience. That transition point is patience. You know, all the ways that we talk about the levels of meaning, that is the way. You know, if you can, you perforce must serve the master at the bottom. That's where you begin. You're plopped right down there on the zeroth level. If you can extend yourself, not sever that, but extend yourself all the way up, until you've grabbed every level all the way up to the sixth level, and have a full grip on the whole spectrum, then an amazing eventuation happens. Eventually, that conquest, you know, you bring that whole thing, structure up, like I pointed out, it becomes a circle, cosmic character. You begin to build your circles, you know, that can move ever inward. You know, every time that you can span something from law to love, boink, it now connects to the cosmos.
Right.
At least at the initial seventh, you know, yeah, level. That's the way you do it internally. It also can kind of give you a sense of, if you can, you know, it, like they said, if the supreme decision is to become godlike, if you can stretch that, see, then it has, then it engages supremacy.
When I was in Minnesota, my brother-in-law, who's a real fundamental Christian, and I had some interesting conversations this morning. But his main thing was very biblical and very Old Testament and very God is wrath, God is just. So he was at that level of justice, and did not see that it was possible, that it was simple for God to embrace both absolutely and infinitely, both justice and mercy at the same time, in perfect harmony. No, you're wrong about that. He's justice. Okay, fine.
I mean, this is the whole thing. It's this long-standing dichotomy.
Yeah.
You know, remember, they point out, I mean, you know, even though it's way up there, you know, you have this encirclement of the Holy Spirit. You have that third cosmic intuition, and you can stick your finger into that sixth level, you know, a bit. You know, even if you haven't really kind of properly built the foundation underneath it, you know, so even if your opposite of justice isn't just the feelingness on the second level of meaning, you know, which you're calling spiritual and blah blah blah, you know, let's say give the person some credit. Let's say he actually has, you know, is predicating that on some connection to the sixth level of meaning, but he has nothing in between.
Yeah.
Okay, that's no better than the person, you know, which is better, to be laying on a foundation which is very low, but at least it's stable,
solid,
or to build a penthouse with no floors below it. I think maybe the one-brainer process of starting out on the ground floor and slowly and methodically working your way up might be more stable, might take you longer. You know, see, that's what we've talked about that many times, you know. They tell you, you can certainly cultivate a relationship with the third cosmic intuition, you know, ahead of the first two, but it's not that wise. You know, it's an initial thing, okay, but the farther you take that, the more the pyramid is getting built upside down, and it's going to all flop down. Yeah. It's not stable. You've got to have patience. Patience to build it up from the bottom.
Well, that's probably what the angels, a lot of the initial work on the mansion world is all of that imbalance, to rebalance.
Yep. All right.
In the ministry of personal guardianship, the assignment of angels as destiny guardians, seraphim always volunteer their services. In the city of this visitation, a certain mortal was recently admitted to the reserve corps of destiny. And since all such humans are personally attended by guardian angels, more than 100 qualified seraphim sought the assignment. The planetary director selected 12 of the more experienced individuals and subsequently appointed the seraphim whom they selected as best adapted to guide this human being through his life journey. That is, they selected a certain pair of equally qualified seraphim. One of the seraphic pair will always be on duty.
If you stumbled a little bit there, the planetary director, known as the chief of seraphim, you know, and his staff, you know, is the they. I mean, it's not, you know, that's why they combined those two. They're pointing out that it's a, you know, it's not just, you know, him solely. He's got an advisory team involved in that selection process, so that it's a they, you know, selection, but. Yeah, we're talking about the chief of seraphim there.
Seraphic tasks may be unremitting, but either of the angelic pair can discharge all ministering responsibilities. Like cherubim, seraphim usually serve in pairs, but unlike their advanced associates. Less advanced associates. The seraphim sometimes work singly. In practically all their contacts with human beings, they can function as individuals. Both angels are required only for communication and service on the higher circuits of the universes.
So there's a literal energy thing. They talk about that in other places in the book. You know, and they plug in, they need both poles of the battery. I mean, it's a very literal energy phenomenon going on.
When a seraphic pair accept guardian assignment, they serve for the remainder of the life of that human being. The complement of being, one of the two angels, becomes the recorder of the undertaking. These complemental seraphim are the recording angels of the mortals of the evolutionary worlds. The records are kept by the pair of cherubim, a cherubim and a seraphim, who are always associated with the seraphic guardians. But these records are always sponsored by one of the seraphim.
Okay, just before we read that last little bit, they're counting on you, just like referring to all the different levels, in their organization. They're counting on you remembering all the things that they've said about, angels and related beings and previous papers. The this complemental seraphim, the complement of being, that's a specific term that they use to when they're talking about these, when it's not a male female like pair, like material sons and daughters or you and I, when it's these when the pairing is described as positive and negative, aggressive, retiring, words like that. That the negative, the retiring one, is the complement of being. Okay, so that's one of the two angels. It's that one. You notice how they're not stressing all of those technical details here. They're kind of just glossing over them. But technically, it's that one. It's the quote unquote negative or retiring angel that is the complement of being.
It's also a very yin-yang type thing, oriental-minded.
I mean, the seraphim is the complement of being in the cherubim, seraphim pair.
For purposes of rest and recharging with the life energy of the universe circuits, the guardian is periodically relieved by her complement. And during her absence, the associated cherubim functions as the recorder, as is also the case when the complemental seraphim is similarly absent.
Okay, so her, specifically using her there. So they're just giving the technicality here. Okay, so if the complement of being is the real recording seraphim, she is always key to this. Well, think about this then. If she's off, resting, obviously she can't be recording the situation, so the cherubim is taking that. If the other one is if the positive angel is off resting, so that the complement of being has to be in charge of the situation, she can't be recording. So they're just pointing out, technically, unless the two of them are actually there working together, the cherubim is going to be literally doing the recording. But that angel is always going to have oversight over that, before it gets submitted or anything like that. She's always going to be making sure that it's all in order, and she's in charge of the integrity of that record, even though an awful lot of the time she may not be literally the one that's writing it down.
So literally, when you... Do I have this right? When you reach the third circle or some of these other things, you get a guardian of destiny, you get two. But there are also the, quote, associated cherubim and seraphim.
Cherubim, seraphim pair working with them.
So you get four.
Right. You get four angels in the more generalized sense of it, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Never mind, you know, the thing that's almost wholly unspoken of, you know, very, very definitively, you know, not touched upon here. You know, there's only one spot that is really, you know, that they tip their hand a little bit. You know, way back on the Seraphington, you know, the Seraphington, you know, description, there is a lower order of angels that they basically cannot speak of.
Violation of trust.
Yeah, because it would be akin to a violation of trust. There is that much more material-like order of angels that is unspoken, you know, by and large. Just that, a couple little hints.
So it's between
and how much of them are in play is... See, it's very not said.
what are the archangels?
Well, that's,
oh, that's,
you know,
their highest.
Yeah, that's, you know, they are. You know, you'll see. You know, as you know, if you think about more about what they say about the relationship between, you know, actual angels and the so-called archangels, you know, you begin to see why they chose to use that. You know, again, pre-existent term we had, you know, that it isn't just confusing, like you might think, because, you know, there's a strong tendency in, like, Christian lore for archangels just to be archangels, you know, whereas and here they're a separate group of beings. They're not just the, you know, the mucky muck angels. You know, they're a whole different order of beings, but they have a lot of relationships to the angels that can give that term sort of new meaning. You know, plus draw upon a number of the associations that we have in pre-existent writing, where we say an archangel is doing such and so. You know, so, but but anyway, you know, the but more along that lines is, you know, what about Supernaphim, you know, which you could also say are angels. You know, now that they're a type of angel that in many ways is the heel-like of an archangel, that is more in line kind of with what you were just sort of thinking. You know, there is a big spectrum, and you'll see that comes up, you know, later in this paper. Let's see. So is someone else... Want to take it up here?
Yeah.
You know, and if you're going to read either, maybe oh. come here so that, you know, camera can pick you up.
And this paragraph is very, probably one of the more important, as far as angels is concerned. It gives a real synopsis of how important they are in our lives.
Yeah.
Number 3, relation to other spirit influences. One of the most important things a destiny guardian does for the mortal subject...
For her mortal subject
is to affect a personal coordination of the numerous impersonal spirit influences which indwell, surround, and impinge upon the mind and the soul, of the evolving mortal material creature. Human beings are personalities, and it is exceedingly difficult for non-personal spirits and pre-personal entities to make direct contact with such highly material and discreetly personal minds. In the ministry of the guardian angel, all of these influences are more or less unified and made more nearly appreciable by the expanding mortal nature of the evolving human personality.
Moral nature.
Yeah, like Jim was prefacing there. Think of how many things they've woven into that little paragraph there. There's a number of very key things to appreciate here. You know, this whole bit about in this life we perforce serve two masters, and we've been, you know, invoking that in our kind of two hemisphere picture a number of times here. That whole lower domain, you know, that's dominated by subjective adjutant mind. Nonetheless, you know, personality is identified with that very, very fundamentally material grounded self. You know, as lowly as it is in many respects, nonetheless, personality is directly identified with it, not with some really, really high thing, with it. Okay? This animal origin self. And see, they're pointing out this leads to some definite difficulties. Because what is personality? You know, many things, but one of the things it is this intense focusing phenomenon. Potentially, hence, isolating phenomenon. If you focus yourself so much that you snap all the links, to the rest of the cosmos. You don't want to implode because personality can focus. Okay? But even in a non-imploding state, that personality has really got a real grip down there, and these very unity-like, spread all out through the cosmos spirit ministries that are trying to engage it, they're trying to somehow bring a near-infinite sheet into relationship with a tight little ball, and they're just not the same morphology. It's just not like two sheets coming together and there's lots of interface, okay? You got one tiny little point of contact, okay? And this is what it's that image that they're trying to invoke here. The angel is there, like I said, is trying to help this linkage to get that self more connected into the bigger picture. Okay? So there isn't just that one little single point contact. It's trying to get you to begin to flatten out your nature to let more of, to let go and let God a little bit more. Let yourself, don't be afraid. Let go a little bit. Let it reach up. And the angel, it isn't in there, with a pry bar trying to somehow, pry this up or something. It can't do that. Like they'll talk about it a little bit. It's going to set up circumstances where the only way you can make it through is to become less of a tight little ball, in the fetal position, okay, all afraid. You're going to have to, expand your, the extent to which you engage that which is above you in order to make it through. You're going to need the spiritual strength, that comes from having more than one little contact point with spirit. You need more and more and more points of contact, okay? So that, just in that opening paragraph, if you let what they're saying have a direct visualization in these pictures they've been drawing, you can see exactly what the job of the guardian angels are. This is what their challenge is: how to get you to go out of the fetal position, which is more than material. It's at the full level of personality. Personality can transcend matter, mind, and spirit, and make you a tight little ball in spite of, everything that would want to open it up. Okay? So
that was what Jesus was referring to when people just delved into the unhappiness of self. It just deeper and deeper is.
Right. Don't use
why it's unhappiness.
Just think about what this personality can do. It can, remember, it's spirit pattern. Okay, so really, how could you picture it taking this material energy basically and really making it into a tight ball? Puts a spirit skin around it. Okay? Okay? And you're inside. And the thicker that skin, the more all you see is your reflection off that skin on the inside. Okay? It's not transparent. The tighter you lock this down, the thicker that gets. And like we were just alluding a little bit ago, you can make it so thick that it literally disconnects and you bubble off and disappear. Okay, but obviously it's not going to take too much, and all you're going to see is a mirror of yourself when you look up or to the side or any direction. You're going to be in this little mirrored ball. Okay? Okay? You don't want to do that. You know, you don't want the reflection to be off that casing. You want the reflection, see, to go through the core, connect to the cosmos. This is the, like, you want this to reflect that, not this to reflect itself. That's the difference between righteousness and self-righteousness. Yeah. Do you reflect yourself or the cosmos?
So the technique that the angel uses, as they were talking on the previous page, mm-hmm. is that they have an abiding affection for the individual. And with that, they can then make it appreciable, make all of these spirit influences. How do I appreciate, as the self you're talking about, appreciate all of these things and move up that ladder of understanding and let and expand that ball you're talking mm-hmm. about? Only via the, well, you have to participate, but the angels is, with that affection, is the key to the contact of who you are, their contact with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and literally, I mean, you can see how, you know, when we talk about the full picture where we have two hemispheres, well, you know, that lower part has this big flat surface. You see, that's the whole, you're trying to really get that, you know, instead of a ball, you know, in an unused space up here, you know, kind of, mm-hmm. you know, you don't want it to be so hourglass, you know, like really, you know, two little balls with one point of contact. You're trying to get it really into that two hemisphere shape. So there's this whole flat surface on the top of that lower domain that's connected above, not just that point. It's, so just think of it literally like that. Oh, wait, so we're down here.
More especially, can and does this seraphic guardian correlate the manifold agencies and influences of the infinite spirit, ranging from the domains of the physical controllers and the adjutant mind spirits up to the Holy Spirit and the divine ministers and to the omnipresent spirit presence of the paradise third source and center. That's quite a range.
Mm-hmm.
Having thus unified and made more personal these vast ministries of the infinite spirit, the seraphim then undertakes to correlate these integrated influences of the conjoined actor with the spirit presence of the Father and the Son. No wonder they have to be experienced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, read a little bit more and then we'll talk about some of that.
The adjuster is the presence of the Father, the spirit of truth, the presence of the Son. These divine endowments are unified and coordinated on the lower levels of human spiritual experience by the ministry of the guardian seraphim. The angelic servers are gifted in combining the love of the Father and the mercy of the Son in their ministry to mortal creatures. And herein is revealed the reason why the seraphic guardians eventually become the personal custodians of the mind patterns, memory formulas, and soul realities of the mortal survivors during that interval between physical death and Marantia resurrection. None but the ministering children of the infinite spirit could thus function on behalf of the human creature during this phase of transition from one level of the universe to another and higher level. Even when you engage in your terminal transition slumber, when you pass from time to eternity, a high supernaphim likewise shares the transit with you as the custodian of creature identity and the surety of personal integrity.
Okay. So, they're trying to point out sort of the literal consequences of these seraphim being the offspring of the creative mother spirit. Remember, the creative mother spirit, what kind of deity is she composed of? You know, there's two types of deity, together as one, to make the type of deity she is, and hence, you know, what type of offspring are going to come from that type of deity. She's the spirit type deity, as you said, you know, a downstepped expression directly of the infinite spirit as just a creative spirit. And then subsequent to the primary eruption, when the Trinity, you know, puts its component into this, the Mother, you know, so it's the Spirit and the Mother, those two types of deity, you know, hyphenated, together as one. So when you look at an offspring of the created Mother Spirit, they're going to have a very direct ability to engage the full spectrum of the infinite spirit, but more. They're also going to be able to embrace the fullness of that which goes beyond the spirit, the all are the Mother. Okay, but so look at how this works. How does, you know, so think about it, just the way the created Mother Spirit starts as just the Spirit, a downstep expression of the Spirit, and then the Mother's added in. And the greater picture is added in. Same thing here. From the full spectrum, all the way from mechanical mind with the physical controllers, all the way up to the omnipresent Spirit, you know, in other words, the infinite Spirit, Spirit presence of the infinite Spirit. That full spectrum of the Spirit, okay, that's the first thing that they can definitely, you know, work on getting you fully engaged to. Okay, and then once you have that full place, they can begin to engage this direction into it of bringing the Father and the Son ministries. You know, this, the thought of Jester and the Spirit of Truth into this. You get the whole picture. But see, what allows them to bridge that gap between, you know, what's basically an expression of the third source and center? How do they bring the second and the first source and center in with it? The only way they can do that is if they have something within them that transcends those three. What is that called? It's called the Paradise Trinity. You know, the super additive consequence of the three together. Now, where does the Mother come from? The Trinity. Okay? It's because they have that direct expression of the Mother coming from the Trinity that they can engage the whole picture and make it an all are. Okay? The whole spirit's spectrum can be an all are that you can be in relationship to. See, so there it is right there. See, if you just think about technically why they could do what they just described and how they described it, you know, you know, they don't start with the adjuster. They don't even start with the Spirit of Truth, which you might think, well, that bridged all the gaps. Wouldn't that be a place to start? No. They start the same place that Jesus started the first time he introduced the kingdom of heaven. You know, when the first time Jesus used that that metaphor, what did he tie it to when he was talking to the apostles? He didn't tie it to all of the dozens and dozens of things that he tied it to over the course of his public ministry. He tied it to one thing the very first time he used it, to the Holy Spirit. The actual domain, the kingdom, within that temple, you know, that's created by the Holy Spirit. That's the place. So the first thing the angel does is work on getting the place fully in order. And then there really is a solid place for the Spirit of Truth and the thought adjuster to engage you. They can't minister, you know, to that adjutant domain. They can only minister in that upper domain. And if that's going to have any relationship to you, you have to have a good relationship to it. See? So they build on getting you into this full mode where you have a real linkage with all of this, you know, higher ministry. You know, it's not just the physical, you know, the non-teachable mind and the adjutant mind down here. It's the full spectrum. Even they tell it bringing in things that we can't even comprehend relative to the omnipresent spirit. Okay? Which maybe kind of gives it sort of a real wholeness, you know, wrapped around all this. But now you really have a place for those other ministries. And she brings those in perfect harmony because she has that mother-like character, the all-are-like character. It can transcend the mere spirit, bring in the Son and the Father and the Trinity whole.
Chris?
Yep.
And yet we're told that the adjuster comes approximately age 6. So, you know, right, comes, these things are developed.
Right, comes but can't do much.
Okay.
Yeah, like we talked about a lot back there. I mean, when does the adjuster really start to be able to do a lot of things? When you get to the third circle and you have a pair of seraphim, and, you know, we talked a lot about that. You know, and notice how a lot of what we're talking about here is in that mode. You know, you want to really be shooting towards that. You want to get to the point where you really have this full picture in play, and now something can really start to happen. Let your guardian angels work with you. You know, don't be lazy. They're going to poke you with a sharp stick. You know, don't turn away. Turn right at it. Go at it. You know, when they send a great big wave at you, what's the worst thing you can do if you're out in a little ship on the high seas and a great big wave is coming at you? The worst thing you can do is turn,
right,
and try to run.
Yeah.
You're dead.
Yeah.
Okay? You want to turn right dead square into it.
Yeah.
90 degree to the wave front.
Yeah.
And go right square into it. That's what the angels are trying to get you to do, to stop turning away. They're trying to get you to have the courage to go right into it. Because then and only then will you begin to develop this full character that can now be a place that higher ministries can engage.
So, Chris, two questions. First one's easy. It says when a mortal breaks through the inertia of animal legacy and attains the third circle of human intellectuality and acquired spirituality, a personal angel, parentheses, in reality, too.
Right.
Did Jesus have a personal angel or in reality, too, at the Garden of Gethsemane?
Two.
Okay, the next question, a harder question.
Now, but remember what they just told you. I mean, there's probably only one on duty at any given time.
Yeah.
Seldom are they both going to be there simultaneously on duty.
Yeah, probably. But they might have been with him.
Maybe. You can only speculate.
It wasn't your everyday night.
It wasn't your everyday night.
So here's the harder question. What do you think the day in a life is like for a guardian seraphim watching over a fifth level circle person and a third circular person? What do they do all day?
Well,
they're busy.
They're, remember, what was the word that
now
they
they're busy for? Doing what?
Where was it? Didn't we just, I believe we just read it. Wasn't it was in the previous section they used the term unremitting. Didn't we just read that?
Yeah.
Can't remember exactly where that was. I mean, so it's unremitting, regardless of whether or not they're dealing with seven circlers or third circlers.
Yeah, but what do they do all day?
Well, you know, we're kind of getting to that. They're trying to build speed bumps for you. They're trying to build great big waves that the only way you can handle them is for you to turn 90 degrees into them. That's their job. They try to build some real spiritual strength in you. It takes spiritual strength to hold this. If you don't have spiritual strength, you bubble off. Only spiritual strength can hold that material character open so that it's not so individuality-like and is trying to strike step with some unity. At least have one unity-like base on it, you know. It balls down to a point all the way down to the bottom still. But, you know, it's a little more unity-like. Only spiritual strength can hold that open. Weakness, you know, cowardice, all, you know. Anguish, anxiety, and dread. You know,
but Chris, it wouldn't be all speed bumps that they'd be doing, because the angels bring people together, so they've got to be doing other things than speed bumps. They've got to be harmonizing and helping. And
sure, but you know, how do they bring them together?
People aren't speed bumps.
Yeah, the relationship.
How do you get cattle into a pen? Cattle prods.
Yeah. Well, cats.
How do you herd cats?
How do you herd these cats?
You don't do it with wishful thinking. You know, it takes some, you know. So they build a wall here, and you go, okay, all right. They build a wall here. Oh, okay. You know, they build chutes. I mean, they don't have to literally hit you with a, you know, electric probe, but they at least have to make things that turn you.
So you're saying that there's so many of them that watch over us, not because they love us so much, but because it takes a village to raise us.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, it's they're a lot like you know, sheepdogs, you know, in many ways. They're trying to keep us, you know, from drifting off the reservation. You know?
don't see in the future, I'll see in the past.
You know, Christians, traditional Christians, and I have one Christian friend, and he's still a very faithful Christian, and they're always talking in these terms, but they say, God closed this door, God opened this door, God closed the door, you know, constantly thinking like that, if they're dedicated Christians, you know.
Yeah. And again, see, what does the Revelation do? The Revelation say, oh no, all those are silly notions. No. No, there's a very strong element of truth in that. Just like they do with everything that you can think of that's coming to us evolutionarily like that. You know, why is that a long-standing notion in religious circles? Because there's a measure of truth in it. Humans have gotten it, you know, it almost feels like there was this wall that popped up, you know, we see, and you only discover this in, you know, in retrospect. You know, after you've finally been rattled down the chute, you get to the point and you go, ah, glory, glory. Then you go, well, now how did I end up there? And then you turn around and it's like, you know, it's almost like a wall popped up and made me go this way instead of that way. Yeah, yeah, maybe it did. Literally. I mean, you know, like the point not coming up. I mean, sometimes they literally bring in the master physical controllers to make walls that are pretty literal. Again, you literally can't go that direction because there's literally a wall. Okay? I keep wanting to point to you. Sorry.
On the spiritual level, seraphim make personal, any otherwise impersonal, pre-personal ministries of the universe. They are coordinators. On the intellectual level, they are the correlators of mind and mirage. They are interpreters. And on the physical level, they manipulate terrestrial environment through their liaison with the master physical controllers and through the cooperative ministry of the midway creatures.
Okay. Just like I was saying,
just answer most questions.
Yeah, and just notice they're bringing in, you know, a little bit more of the picture here too. You not only have all of that spiritual ministry that's going on, but the mind is there, they're helping. You have these two selves, you have the adjutant self and the Maranja self. Only, you know, the adjutant self has the personality, you know, identification, but there's these two selves, and like we, you know, read back in the reading about the soul, they're pointing out the angelic ministry is helping to get those two selves more and more resonating with each other. That's another thing they're doing on the more directly mindal level rather than spiritual level, and then all the way down to the material. So the full spectrum is in play. And then, just, you know, I didn't want to mention this until we read that. Just, you know, it's really, really the whole spectrum. There isn't anything about you that they aren't trying to, you know, engage here and get a full grip on. And that's why in the previous paragraphs they say, you know, and herein is revealed the reason, you know, why they're the ones that take possession of your soul. And they are the ones that oversee the building of the body that's going to match that soul. Because there isn't anything about that soul and where it's been, what it's been connected to, related to, that they don't have a direct, intimate knowledge of. They have a finger that can touch everything. Whereas other beings can only touch little parts. They know you intimately and completely from you know, way beyond this end that you think is part of you and beyond the other end and everything in between and above. I mean, they just know you completely intimately.
That's the recorder.
Yeah. So not only can they direct building the body, you know, but they literally can hold it. See, they have to be a being that can actually hold such a thing. You know, if they can only hold part of it, well, they'd clunk off, you know, and oops. You know, they've got to be a being that holds the whole thing. See, and that's what they're trying to point. Think of it literally. And herein is revealed the reason. You know, take that literally. Only the seraphim. Not the Supernafim, not the archangels, not the divine counselors. I mean, only the seraphim can literally hold that whole thing.
I think one of the things to answer to most question, what do angels do all day? I mean, there's both an external and internal. They're looking for the next person to associate with outside of you. But internally, that whole business about the mind coordinators and interpreters, whatever you're thinking, they're also doing the, yeah, that's a good thought. Oh, what are you fearing about that? You know, they're doing that fence thing there too. I mean, they're in there trying, but it's not just them. They can't do a damn thing unless you say, hey, help me think right. You've still got that personal will that says, I'm giving you permission, whether it's an angel, a thought adjuster, God the Father himself, in the personality circuit, you're the one who's in control of all of it. You have to say yes to their ministry.
And just, you know, let's see if we can read this next section too, because it's just a short one. And we can pretty much read through it. But I want, you know, I don't want to leave all of that dangling. So here, listen to, here. Because let's pick up the rest of that story.
This is a recital of the manifold and intricate function of an attending seraphim. But how does such a subordinate angelic personality, created but a little above the universe level of humanity, do such difficult and complex things? We do not really know, but we conjecture that this phenomenal ministry is in some undisclosed manner facilitated by the unrecognized and unrevealed workings of the Supreme Being, the actualizing deity of the evolving universes, of time and space. Throughout the entire realm of progressive survival in and through the Supreme Being, seraphim are an essential part of the continuing mortal progression.
Okay, so just, you know, the little things I noticed there are, you know, that amazing omission. We do not really know. Okay, who's the we? This is written by the chief of seraphim, but, you know, this is post-rebellion, we don't have a seraphim as the chief of seraphim. Who do we have as the chief of seraphim? A primary supernaphim. Okay? A primary supernaphim is an angel that is only beget by just the infinite spirit. Okay? You know, in terms of angels, it's not a heck of a lot of immediate mother-likeness. See? Very, very... I mean, this is an admission, you know, of the nature of a primary supernaphim. When the primary supernaphim looks at what a seraphim can do, primary supernaphim, seraphim, okay, can do, how in the world do they do that? Okay, why are they confused? Because they literally don't have an intimate understanding of just what more mother-likeness within them, you know, gives you. They're very father-like. That's why he's here as the chief of seraphim. You know, there's a rebellion. You know, our chief of seraphim goes into default. What happens? Mr. Intervention. Okay, not Mrs. Mr. Intervention. The primary supernaphim comes in. Okay, it's a very, very aggressive father-like, you know, intervention.
Yeah.
That act.
Who's your daddy?
Okay, and that fact, see, is revealed again here. They're going, well, I just don't really understand that. Now, I know a lot about it. I mean, think about how much they know about it. You know, they've been watching it for trillions of years, okay? They know everything about it, except actually know it. They have no internal recognition, direct knowing of the mother-likeness that's within that lowly seraphim that can do that. That can take the thing that's the farthest over here and the farthest over here across the Trinity and connect the two together.
That's that circle you're talking about.
Right. So you can just, you know, notice how powerful a why thrown in there is, you know. And he says, you know, we really, you know, you go, why do you not really know? Right. And if you can answer that question, you make a whole bunch of discoveries. And then the other thing they're bringing in, see, again, is the mother. I mean, you know, look at what they're saying here. You know, even though he doesn't really know, he conjectures that it must have something to do with that oversoul, that absentite being, that supreme being, and the way that Oversoul inserts himself into time and space as, gee, Universal Mother. But just that whole thing is doesn't quite grok that. You know, and you notice how he tends to speak very much. He understands the Supreme Being very intimately. That whole Almighty Supreme Universal Mother expression in the finite of that absolute Supreme Being, that's not very intimately understandable to this Supernathan. That's, see, it's all right there in the way he says what he says there. All right, let's just, who'd like to, who's a good reader that can jump in and give us these additional little thoughts here?
Gene can do it.
Even though it's pushing a little bit here, this, you know, we've been pointing at, alluding to this so much, let's just read this a little bit.
Number 4, seraphic domains of action. The guardian seraphim are not mind, though they do spring from the same source that also gives origin to mortal mind, the creative spirit. Seraphim are mind stimulators. They continually seek to promote circle-making decisions in human mind. They do this not as does the adjuster operating from within and through the soul, but rather from the outside, inward, working through the social, ethical, and moral environment of human beings. Seraphim are not the divine adjuster lure of the Universal Father, but they do function as the personal agency of the ministry of the Infinite Spirit.
Just see that? I mean, that should initially strike you as sounding cold. And they're wanting to challenge you a little bit there. They don't want you to think of the angel as a warm fuzzy that actually has her fingers inside of your mind. She does not. She's outside, wholly outside. And what does she have to work with? Social, ethical, and moral environment. She's being manipulated. You know, especially when you bring in the other seraphim, they're really doing the father-like stuff. Angels of nation life. Okay, that's really, manipulating some of that environmental stuff, external stuff. Okay. That's how they have to do this. Think of the skill it takes to manipulate that environment that you're in to get you to try to let go, and create this true form. How much of a social, ethical, and moral challenge is it going to take to get you to do that? To have the courage to do that?
Mortal man, subject to adjuster leading, is also amenable to seraphic guidance. The adjuster is the essence of man's eternal nature. The seraphim is the teacher of man's evolving nature. In this life, the mortal mind, in the next, the Maruncha soul. On the mansion worlds, you will be conscious and aware of seraphic instructors, but in the first life, men are usually unaware of them.
The adjuster is the essence of man's father-like nature. The seraphim is the teacher of man's mother-like nature.
Seraphim function as teachers of men by guiding the footsteps of the human personality into paths of new and progressive experiences. To accept the guidance of a seraphim rarely means attaining a life of ease. And following this leading, you are sure to encounter, and if you have the courage, to traverse the rugged hills of moral choosing and spiritual progress. The impulse of worship largely originates in the spirit promptings of the higher mind adjutants, reinforced by the leadings of the adjuster. But the urge to pray, so often experienced by God-conscious mortals, very often arises as the result of seraphic influence. The guardian seraphim is constantly manipulating the mortal environment for the purpose of augmenting the cosmic insight of the human ascender, to the end that such a surviving candidate may acquire enhanced realization of the presence of the indwelling adjuster and thus be enabled to yield increased cooperation with the spiritual mission of the divine presence.
Look at how vivid that paragraph is with the pictures we've been painting. Like that whole bit of the purpose of augmenting the cosmic insight of the human ascender to the end that such a survival candidate may acquire enhanced realization of the presence of the indwelling adjuster. Okay? The adjuster's up here, and you're down here, and okay, you've got very little, you know, recognition of the presence of the adjuster. But if the angel can help you expand your relationship to the three cosmic intuitions, your cosmic insight, so that you actually extend yourself up into that upper domain, then there's this great big doorway here, and you look through the doorway, and what do you see up there? The adjuster. The adjuster can't, you know, really work down here. Right? It's been up there. You know, because of Pentecost, you know, we have this incredible grace that, you know, before you really can have much relationship up there, the adjuster's up there. You know, it's working on the soul, but there's not a heck of a lot of relationship to you through that tiny little contact point. But, you know, if you can expand your cosmic insight, you know, then you'll start to see the adjusters up there. And look at that other direct relationship to the two wings. Okay? The impulse of worship largely originates in the spirit promptings of the higher mind adjutants. Of course, the religious impulse, the spirit of worship. You know, that's that kick. And then, like they've said many times, obviously the adjuster is going to try to foster that because, you know, when it goes from just the mere impulse down there in adjutant mind to worship, if you really get a linkage here and you have connection to true worship, this wing, the adjuster's facilitating that. So there's really a connection here. You're going to have more than just the sixth adjutant, you know, the notion that maybe there is such a thing as worship, but you'll actually be connected to true worship and it will be, you know, directed upward towards that. The adjuster is doing the worship wing. And what does it say directly there? Who's doing the prayer wing?
The seraphim.
This one. Prayerful contemplation, worshipful contemplation. It's just directly stated there. This is literally, you know, these two wings of relationship. One to the self, one to the cosmos.
While there is apparently no communication between the indwelling adjusters and the encompassing seraphim, they always seem to work in perfect harmony and exquisite accord. The guardians are most active at those times when the adjusters are least active, but their ministry is in some manner strangely correlated. Such superb cooperation can hardly be either accidental or incidental.
Again, the seraphim is scratching his head a little bit because he's thinking father-like. That's individual point-to-point relationship. Nothing else in the universe. Point-to-point individual relationship. But that's not what's in play here. It's not the I am. It's the all are. Yeah? And again, remember we talked about how that, you know, the relationship of the thought adjuster, because it's a, you know, it's an individuation of the infinite upholder. The depth expressions are the mother. It can bring that into play. This whole bit is some manner strangely correlated. I'm looking at it. There is no point-to-point communication. They don't even get to see each other. They've never talked to each other once. They've never passed a note under the desk. They've never done anything. How in the world are they connected? Yeah. Connected in the whole. Yeah. And the Supernathim is just very honestly admitting that that's really hard for him to comprehend how that could be. All he can go is, well, I can think about it. Is that he the Supreme Being? And I don't know, maybe there's some sort of mysterious magic, you know, that somehow is, you know, the Supreme is transcendent. I mean, he's kind of in that mode. See, yeah. You and I, because we have an adjuster, we can do what we're doing right here. We can talk about this much more intimately, and we can nod our heads. It's like, yeah, I know that. That's not just a notion. Mm-hmm. I know that. There's something more than a point-to-point. You know, there's an all-R that I know I'm connecting to. You know, and I recognize that my life has experiences related to that. Those coincidences, you know, where I know that there was no point-to-point manipulation, you know, to get those two things at the same place at the same time. They just coincidentally came to be at the same place at the same time. That's the mother hand. That's not the father intervention hand. That's just the supremacy hand.
Right. The ministering personality of the guardian seraphim, the God presence of the indwelling adjuster, the encircuited action of the Holy Spirit, and the Son consciousness of the Spirit of Truth are all divinely correlated into a meaningful unity of spiritual ministry and into a mortal personality. Though hailing from different sources and different levels, these celestial influences are all integrated in the enveloping and evolving presence of the Supreme Being.
Enveloping.
So when you feel alone next time, you know, you got all of these touch points.
Even if you can't see that laser light, even if you've gotten turned, you know, and are looking away from that laser beam of the father-like laser beam of the adjuster, you're never alone. The womb is right there. If you would just, you know, open your eyes, reach up. It's there. Mother is there everywhere. You know, there's a complete enveloping. You know, and see, and it's so important to have it end like that, with enveloping, the security of that, because you've got to combine that with the harsh paragraph in the middle there. You know, what did it say? It said, in following this leading, you are sure, not maybe, sure to encounter. And if you have the courage to traverse the rugged hills of moral choosing and spiritual progress. Yeah. Those are the speed bumps, you know, that we so often metaphorically, you know, speak up. You know, what she's literally doing is tough love. Very tough love. And she can do that because she also can do the father thing really well. she can just set the whole she thing aside and be very he-like. You know, it's like an angel of nation life, something, okay? But in this mode, she's bringing the he and the she, and the she together. And of course, it's the she-ness that allows the he-ness, you know, to be in there, you know, for that tough love to not just be tough, but to also be love, you know? She's enveloping, but she's going to challenge you, you know, right to your limits. Holding you intimately, ever pushing you. The moment that you've rose to a challenge, she immediately is bringing the next bigger challenge into play. You know? So get comfortable with that womb. You know, you're going to need that comfort. You know? Because what did it say? Her ministry is unremitting. So guess what that means for you?
The workout won't.
The challenge is unremitting. You know? It's going to constantly be coming at you. You know, if it was just every once in a while that you're going to be challenged, then her job would not be unremitting. Her job would be episodic. Okay? And it's not. It's unremitting. So, really, you know, really fascinating. You know, just getting that far into this. You know, the comparison to all of the mythology, you know, or actual biblical stories of angels and whatnot. You know, just look at how far the revelation takes you. Just getting into section 4 here. And a complete transformation of your relationship to an angel. Yeah, really glorious. And then really, really noticing how much we had to talk about the mother and not just the father to really understand what they wrote here even. To make sense out of it. It's just so important, like that we've got that now in our arsenal of understanding. We can bring that to bear on that, because you know, we can really feel like we know what they're talking about now. All right, so we'll proceed forward with this next time. And like I said, we're moving towards some of the real farmer-like stuff when we get to the next paper to combine with this. Let's take a little moment here.